So we are in the last one third of this text, and after having talked about the benefits and what is meditation, what do we meditate on, in this particular chapter Swamiji is kind of summarizing or updating us on the technique. We all know this technique, so I won't spend too much time on it, but just go through briefly the points, and then some of the points I may want to emphasize more, the last four. The first four we all know because we have been meditating, so I won't spend too much time on it. So the first is to have a comfortable seat, and we all know that the seat neither should be too hard. If it's too soft, like a soft, you know, mattress, you will sink. If it's too hard, it will be uncomfortable. It should be a comfortable seat, you know, neither too high nor too low, you know, where your feet are dangling or where, you know, you are, I mean, ground level you can sit, but even there you should have something to sit on. Otherwise, prolonged sitting, your, you know, body gets tired. And it should allow you to sit for a longer period of time. That's very important, because meditation, initially we do it only 20 minutes or so, but as we start enjoying it, it's good to extend it. In fact, some sects in Hinduism, some of the branches, they ask them to meditate for 2.5 hours every morning. So 1/10 of your 24-hour day should be spent in. That's, of course, excessive. I don't think anybody can do that. They probably even then, they ask them to wake up at 3:30, meditate to 6. I'm sure they sleep half the time and all that. So, but anyway, so. And then the back should be erect, not stiff. We all know that, because if the back is slouching or, you know, crooked and like a question mark, then you're likely to fall asleep. And then also the flow of energy through our body is good when the back is erect. And then Swamiji talks about the body should have a thought massage. What do we mean by thought massage? That I start from the head and basically relax each part of the body, like mentally massage it so that each part of the body becomes relaxed. So the face, the neck, the shoulders, you know, like that, go down and then come back up. So massaging each part of the body to make it relaxed. And that is the idea. So also paying attention to each part kind of makes your attention from the environment to inward. So you're slowly going inward. So after having relaxed the body, then you start focusing on the mind and intellect, which is called the thought parade. Because the mind is the biggest problem in meditation. Actually, next week, the chapter we're doing is very beautiful, which is the techniques for taming the mind. And there Swamiji has covered every possible technique. So we'll do that next week. There are about 10 or 12 techniques he has given. And we all need that, because the mind is the biggest obstacle when we start meditating. It's racing. It's either running into the past or running into the future. And so he says you should make it like a thought parade, just as when you're watching a parade and the parade is going by, and you don't have anybody in the parade, you don't have a child or anybody, and you watch the parade as a disinterested observer. Okay, the parade is going on. So you were there before the parade, you're standing on the balcony, the parade comes, and then as the parade goes, you remain the observer. The parade has come and gone. It's ended, but you are still there. So similarly, the thoughts will come. You watch them like a parade of thoughts. The thoughts are parading, and I'm the observer. So before the thought arose, I was there, I the consciousness, and I the observer. And then once the thought is there, I am still there. And as you observe the thought, slowly the thought will die down. Or even if it is moving, I am not involved in the thought. So then the thought cannot affect me, not only in meditation, but they recommend throughout the day that one should make an attempt to be a witness. I am watching my mind. So me and the mind are separate. The mind so much takes over us that we become so stressed out, because I am the mind and the mind is stressing me. But if I become the observer of the mind, slowly practice what I do in meditation, do it throughout the day, and you will find that slowly you're able to distance yourself from the mind. And there is always somebody who is watching the mind, and slowly that somebody becomes is me, you know, that becomes a little clearer. So it's almost like there is a little level of detachment from the mind. The mind is functioning, the mind is happy, unhappy. Even the activities that are going on, one can develop this attitude of detachment where whatever is happening, I am watching, but I am not involved. And so one does all activities, but there is a slight distance between me and the world, me and this body. And that comes with practice as you detach from the mind and as you observe the mind. So make it a habit to what I'm doing in meditation, carry it on. Okay, what is my mind doing now? Is my mind happy? Is my mind unhappy? Is it angry? Is it passionate? Is it jealous? Is it peaceful? Is it calm? Is it happy? Is it compassionate? So watching the mind and watching the parade of thoughts. See, thoughts come like a parade, but I am the observer, the witness. And that is one of the very, very important spiritual exercise. And one can do that throughout the day, even when I'm driving or either when I'm working. When I'm talking to somebody on the phone, I should watch, okay, who is talking? And what is the reaction when this person is telling me good or bad news? What is the reaction of my mind? So start practicing to become an observer of the mind and do that throughout the day, not only in the 20 minutes or half an hour in meditation. The first three we talked about are pretty simple. I think you just came. So the seat and the posture and the body relaxing, we all know that. Now this one I would like to spend some time on, what is form and what is formless. Because God or Om or the consciousness has to be formless. It cannot have a particular form. The moment you say it has a particular form, whether it's Jesus or Buddha or Krishna or Shiva or Mother Goddess, you are limiting it. You are saying that form alone is. So it has to be formless because it is all pervading. And one that is all pervading cannot have a form. If it is everywhere, if it is in the table, in the chair, in this mic, how can it have a form? It cannot. It has to be formless. It is in space. It is in the stars. It is beyond the stars. It is even in heaven, hell, everywhere, beyond that. So it has to be formless. But this formless is very difficult for you and me to contemplate on, because they say it has no shape, it has no form, it has no color, it has no qualities, it has no characteristics, it cannot be described. They say, can you describe it? No. Can I think about it? No. Can I see it? No. Can I hear it? No. Can I smell it, taste it, touch it? No. You cannot even love it, or you cannot even know it. I mean, you can attempt to love, but what is it that I'm loving? And what is it that I'm knowing? It cannot be known because it is the enliverer of the object that knows. I think, were you any of you here Sunday? I think you were here, but I can talk about the telescope example, how this consciousness cannot be known. It's a very beautiful example. So see, I pick up a telescope, a most powerful telescope, like Saturn, you know, recently was close to the Earth, and people, you could actually see Saturn with the naked eye. But see, I have never seen the rings of Saturn. I have heard that they have been described in the books, that there Saturn has rings. So I go to this lab, which has astronomy lab, which has a very powerful, like in LA, and, you know, I get permission to use the telescope. So I, you know, focus the telescope on Saturn and I can see the rings. Wow, you know. So I, the knower, what is the object to be known? Saturn. I am the subject. The object is Saturn that I want to see, and the telescope is the instrument. So there is a subject, knower, the instrument, and the object to be known. For anything, you need three things. For any knowledge, like for this knowledge of this chair that it is black, it is me, the subject, the eyes are my instrument, and they are telling me this chair is black. So the object is the chair, eyes are the instrument, I am the knower. So in this case, the telescope is the instrument. So there has to be an intelligent or a conscious person to see through the telescope. An inert object cannot see. If I put the book there, the book cannot see the telescope. Book may have all the astronomy knowledge, but the book cannot see through the telescope to see Saturn. Now suppose I turn the telescope around upon myself, and the telescope wants to see me. Telescope cannot, because telescope is inert. It has no life of its own. It can be used as an instrument, but the telescope cannot know me. You cannot turn the telescope around. So similarly, this consciousness, which is the Lord, which is the subject, uses the mind and the intellect as an equipment to function in the world and the body. So the mind, intellect, and body are these equipments to function in the world of objects, emotions, and thoughts. Because the consciousness itself doesn't do anything, but the human being is created, and then the human being, which has a body, mind, and intellect, can function in the world of objects, emotions. So the consciousness is the subject, the mind and intellect is the equipment, and the world is the object. So same thing, if I'm seeing the time on the clock, then the consciousness in me is using the mind and intellect and the senses, the eyes. But who is using? The consciousness. The body, mind, and intellect has no life of its own. If the consciousness was not functioning, we would not be able to talk, we would not be able to think, we would not be able to see. So the intellect is like the telescope, and the eyes, they are like the telescope. The consciousness is the observer, and the clock is the Saturn. So I, the consciousness, using this body, mind, and intellect, my eyes can see the clock. My mind says, okay, this is a green clock, and the intellect says the time is 6:47. So they all know it because of the presence of consciousness. Is that clear? So the subject, the instrument, and the object. But suppose the instrument wants to see the consciousness, turn itself around. It can't. Just as the telescope cannot see the observer, so this mind and intellect cannot know the consciousness. So what do they say? How can I then know it? Then why am I sitting here in the meditation class? Why am I reading these books? So what they say is that when the vasanas are reduced, when the selfishness, anger, greed, jealousy, hatred is reduced, and the mind and intellect is stilled, when the mind becomes quiet, and this quiet mind, through all these techniques, you know, relaxing the body, observing the breath, you know, watching the thoughts, doing all that, when the mind becomes still and the mind is turned inward, that still mind, which is a pure mind, which has not much negativity, not much anger, not much selfishness. So that pure mind with minimum vasanas, when it becomes still and turns inward, then that consciousness reveals itself. So the Lord reveals himself to us, or herself, or itself. So I cannot, with my intellect, know it as an object, because it's not an object, it's the subject. But when I still my mind, then I slowly understand that consciousness reveals itself, the Lord reveals itself as I, the higher I, not I, Anil, or I, this body, but I as that consciousness. You know, we have two eyes. We have two personalities, or two, shall we say, the lower and the higher, the lower self and the higher self. The lower self is me, this body, mind, and intellect. The higher self is the consciousness. So that higher consciousness reveals itself, and that is the only way to know it. I cannot put an effort and say I want to know it. All I can do is still my mind. Of course, this knowledge helps. One has to have clarity of thought. One has to have purity of mind. And one has to have nobility of action. So my thoughts have to be clear. My knowledge has to be clear from study. My mind has to be pure with no negativity, and my actions have to be noble at the body level. So when all three things are there, clarity of thought, purity of mind, and nobility of action, and such a person, when they sit in silence, then the Lord reveals himself to us. So that is the best way to describe, because the Lord cannot be seen. Somebody says, if God is everywhere, can you show it to us in a test tube? No, I can't. Can you show it? No, nowhere. So that is. So from the form, one goes to the formless. But we need a form because you cannot love this formless, all-pervading consciousness. Where is this God? How can I see him? No. So God has given us all these forms, whether it is Krishna, or whether it is Guru Nanak, or whether it is Jesus, or whether it is Buddha. So all these various prophets and saints, or the Lord's manifestations, we worship Krishna and Buddha and Krishna and Shiva and Vishnu and the Mother Goddess, all the forms you see as manifestations of that one reality. So from the form, you can go to the formless. So we start out with the form. Okay, I love this particular form. And then I contemplate upon it. I pray to it. I chant the mantras. And as you chant and as you remember the form, slowly the mind becomes still. And then you say, okay, this form, for me, this form is God. But then I respect all other forms. So I do not put down any other form that, oh, Allah is superior to, you know, Jesus. Or no, they are all manifestations of that one. Whether you call him Allah or Jesus or Buddha, doesn't matter, but it is one reality. So I respect all forms, but I have one that form that is dear to me, like my dear Jesus or my dear Guru Nanak or my dear Krishna. So that is, so the from the form, you go to the formless. And that is very important. Pick a particular form that you love, but then do not restrict it, that this alone is God. Everything is God. So see that one God who has created me has created everybody. So we are all one. So that oneness has to occur. And that is the essence of from the form. And then when you see the form, then you see that all forms are that. And ultimately the form disappears and that one consciousness. And me and that consciousness are not separate. So that is the state of understanding. And how do we chant Om? So you all know that. You know, you can chant it loudly. And when you chant it loudly, now loudly means not shouting, but audibly, when you chant Om, then they say pay attention to the sound, because the vibrational quality of Om is so powerful. That when you are chanting, because it is in tune with the cosmic vibrations. The whole universe vibrates at that frequency. So Om, when it is chanted correctly and slowly, it brings you in tune with the vibrational quality of the whole universe and with the vibrational quality of your body. So Om must be chanted. Om is probably the best mantra. That I mean, one can still maybe love, say, the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, or you know, Shri Krishna, Nama, Mama, Om, whatever, Nama Shiva. But Om alone should be chanted, or Om along with the form of God. See, Om Shri Krishna Namaha, or Om Nama Shivaya. But Om should, or just Om by itself, whenever you have an opportunity, just chant Om. When I'm sitting alone doing nothing, just chant Om. And not Om, Om, Om like that, but Om. And feel the vibrational quality, how it's, it's like a tuning fork. You hit it and how it tunes. So same way, tunes your mind to that higher reality. And then as you chant Om, then slowly you can go into the silent Om. From whisper and then go to the silent. And when you are chanting Om silently, then you are paying attention to the silence. That between two Oms, there is a gap. And there is a silence. Pay attention to the silence. Then again, oh. And then slowly lengthen the silence. And ultimately, when the mind becomes completely still, that's called the thoughtless state. Where at this point, your mind is not running anywhere. The mind is still and paying attention to that silence. And if you're able to still your mind, even for a few seconds, even for maybe 30 seconds or a minute or whatever, you will feel a deep sense of joy, of peace, fulfillment, happiness arising from within. And that, once you experience that, it's kind of, wow, it is so beautiful. And then you're not trying to reproduce it or get attached to it. It comes. It is automatic. So you just still your mind and wait, and then your mind will run. The mind will not stay in that thoughtless state. Even the, for the yogis, the mind runs. So Gurudev says, be very alert. Watch the mind. Okay, the mind is quiet and mind is still, and then, you know, stay in that thoughtless. And when the mind runs, then again bring it back. When the mind runs, again bring it back. So it should be done with practice, and it slowly the consciousness reveals itself. It's not a sudden one fine day, psh, you know, I realize the truth. No, it is a gradual process. It's not sudden. So this reminds me of a little story. So this man was on a trip, and his brother was living in his house taking care of his cat and their mother. And he was on an extended trip for several weeks. So he called his brother one day and said, how's my cat doing? Brother says, sorry, you know, your cat died. He said, died? That's not the way to tell, you know. I was so attached to the cat. She had been with me for more than 10 years and I loved her. And just like that, you're saying died? That's, you know, it's a shock. You shouldn't have done that. It hurt me. So, well, what should I have said? She died. I'm sorry. He says, no, you should say it gently. You should reveal it gently. He says, how? He says, well, you should have said, you know, brother, the cat climbed up on the roof. You've heard this? The cat climbed up on the roof and then it wouldn't come down. It was scared. And then the firemen were called and they went in the ladder to rescue the cat. And before they could catch her, she got so scared, she jumped from the roof, broke her neck, and she died. You could have said something like that. You didn't have to say, cat is dead. Oh, okay, I'm sorry, next time I won't do that. So a week later, again, he calls the brother. He says, how's mom doing? He says, well, mom is up on the roof. She's up on the roof. So... So this... knowledge reveals itself gradually. And that's what... So one should not be in a hurry. It's not a hurry-up plan. It's not that today I have to realize. Swami Chinmayananda had a very famous phrase, hasten slowly. And next week we'll talk a little. What do we mean by hasten slowly? Means hasten means I have to reach it. And I have to reach it in this life itself. I can't... I don't know how many more years I will live. So I have to make this my goal and I have to work towards it. But I cannot be impatient. I cannot say, I have to know it today, now. No. Keep on working. Keep on purifying your mind. Keep on studying. Keep on serving. Nobility of action, purity of mind, clarity of thought. You know, have the clear knowledge. And then just as you purify your mind, reduce your vastness, slowly that knowledge will reveal itself. So I have to be patient, but I have to be constant. See, it's not a broken path. It's like, oh, I come for 1 week and then I don't come. Then I meditate for 2 weeks and then I say I'm tired, I'm not getting anywhere. Not like that. It has to be a daily steady pursuit that this is the goal of my life. So constant steady pursuit and ultimately patience is very important, because people get so impatient. Oh, I have been meditating for 6 months. I haven't seen God. God hasn't appeared. I haven't seen any light or blue light, or I haven't heard any sounds. You know, people look for all those things. There is nothing. Nothing will happen. Just your mind will become soft. Your mind will become calmer. There will be less agitation. There will be less disturbance. You will be more accepting of yourself and accepting of others. So it's a gradual change of attitude. You will still do the same work. It's not that suddenly you will give up the world and become a monk. You will still do the same work. You will still, you know, everything will be the same. Just your attitude will change. And so it is like the unfolding of a flower, like a petal, like a bud, how the petals slowly unfold and then the flower reveals its fragrance. So similarly, the consciousness is like a flower which slowly unfolds, and all we have to do is just be a witness to it, be part of it. It's a very beautiful process. I'm sure all of you have progressed on this, but the more you do it, the more it gives you a very great sense of fulfillment that, oh, this is something so wonderful. And I'm always grateful to all our teachers, Gurudev and all the other teachers who have helped me along this path, you know, over the years. So it's really wonderful because it's kind of, they have shown us the path where we have to go. They have given us the GPS, they've given us the directions, but I have to get in the car and go there. You know, the GPS cannot go for me. GPS only can guide me. So these are the meditation steps. So you can read them at home if you want. They are on page 161. At home you can read, but now we have a few minutes. So if anybody has any questions, either on this or any other questions related to meditation or related to any other, maybe some obstacle you are encountering or any other topic of spirituality, you're most welcome. We'll spend about 10 minutes for questions. Yes.
When you mentioned the access to God, to divinity through some forms like Jesus, Buddha,
right,
Krishna, etc., wouldn't you include there also like moments or beautiful moments of revelation that we have as individual looking at a forest or a river or the
yes.
ocean? Sometimes you have those particular moments in which you believe that you are connected.
Right.
Isn't that also a way to have access?
Right. It does not mean only the form. You know, you cannot limit yourself, but Eckhart Tolle calls nature as a doorway.
You're not limited to the...
Not limited to the form. No, you don't have to have the form. But yeah, nature is a very beautiful doorway, you know, which reveals God, because nature is the closest to God. So if you're sitting in front of a river or under a tree or listening to some birds or watching the sunrise or the moon, you know, today will be full moon. So these are manifestations of divinity. So you can see divinity everywhere. You can see it in a flower. You can see in the smile of a child. You can see it in a great talent, like somebody who is beautiful music they are playing, or wonderful acting, or a piece of poetry. That is divinity. So yeah, in fact, for me, astronomy, when I read about the discoveries of astronomy and how they are finding, any article on astronomy, I just devour it, because I love it, because it's like these people, amazing vision they have, and how they can tell us things happening billion of years ago, and they said, oh, this happened exactly on this date. And like these two supernovas colliding, you know, things like that. It's very fascinating. So yeah,
knowledge.
Divinity can be anywhere. Yes.
Knowledge, the knowledge that we can have accents.
Exactly. Right. The knowledge also is there. But yeah, nature is a beautiful portal. That's the word Eckhart Tolle uses. Portal. Portal means doorway. So nature, form, being in the now. The next week we'll talk about some of these methods of quietening the mind. But yeah, that's a very good point. Nature is excellent. So if you can just sit, I try to do that in my backyard, especially Saturday mornings. And even now I've started taking Monday mornings off. I've cut down my work. So what I'll do is I'll wake up in the morning after my meditation, just make a cup of tea. I do get the herbal tea, you know, without the caffeine. And then I just sit in my backyard and just watch. So I've just come out of meditation, so the mind is already quiet. So you can extend the meditation another 15, 20 minutes. It's most beautiful. Yeah, just hear the chirping of the birds and the wind, you know, going through the trees. It's most beautiful.
I always had trouble with this, you know, the form, having a form, because I can't see God as a form, and always thought of it as formless.
Right.
And then just recently it occurred to me, I was reading a book called The Eye of the Storm.
Mm-hmm.
I, me.
Right.
And, you know, his illustration about the storm, a hurricane, you know, turns
right
counterclockwise. In the outer, there's the turbulence,
right,
the storm, the storms of life. And then as you get closer to the center, it's quiet.
Yes.
And I perceive that as being sattvic. You know, there's a,
right.
a cone. Somebody else has a, you know, has a, illustrates a cone-like or a mm-hmm. vortex. It calls it a vortex.
Yes.
So it's coming down. So my base is the sattvic stage, and then left and right, or whatever, is the rajasic and the tamasic
right.
stages. That, and for me, the kind of, you know, lately has been, you know, I wake up automatically, like, where between 3 and 4, and then right. just, you know, I imagine that, and it doing, it be, it's becoming easier for me.
Right. No, that's very good. I mean, whatever works, and if you can quieten your mind that way and stay in the midst of all this, like you said, you're staying in that silence, the sattva, and the rajas and tamas are around me, but they are not affecting me. And you don't necessarily have to have a form. If you can contemplate upon the formless, that's fine. You don't have to have a form. I mean, if you can, if you want to, you can, but it's not obligatory. There are some saints who directly went to the formless. Some thinkers. So yeah, if you don't feel the need for a form, that's good. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. We're not saying that you have to pick up a form and meditate upon it. Idea is to go inward, and the form is always outside. But that form is should slowly lead you to that formless, which is all pervading and which is me. And sometimes, there's one technique of meditation is where you are visualizing the form, and then the form expands, and becomes the whole universe. And then I'm also in that, so I merge in that, I get lost in that. But yeah, there are various techniques. But yeah, the vortex, I think that's beautiful. That's good. That works and gives you peace. That's fine. And we don't force anybody to have a particular form. If you want to meditate on a form, it's fine. If not, it's still good. But if you do go to a church and if you see the form, then it connects you with God, with the formless. So that is the point. But yeah, no, that's good if you can do that. I think that's wonderful. So all these things show that we are progressing on the right path. Yes.
And reading the book and listening to you, you know, experiencing this word detachment, and I gather that's vital to
yes.
achieving the peacefulness and other kinds of qualities of consciousness. How would you become detached about your children? Meaning, a precious human being that you love and care for and worry about and nurture and
right.
protect. Meaning, what's the difference between detachment and not caring? Meaning,
right.
I could never not care about my children, but mm-hmm. I'd rather I'm supposed to be bring a detachment to my relationship with
them. Right. No, actually, we're not saying that you stop loving your children or stop calling them or go to see them and grandchildren. And that's very good. We're not saying that because they are me and it's impossible to detach unless you are that evolved like Buddha or somebody who could just leave his wife and son and go away. I mean, he went for a higher cause, but you and I are not there. Same, I have 3 children. I have 4 grandchildren, you know. We call them, we FaceTime every Saturday. I love to tell them stories. In fact, I may be in the middle of work in the surgery center, but if my granddaughter calls, I drop everything and talk to her for 10, 15 minutes. And my nurses are all surprised, you know, who is he talking to? He's telling a story of lion and mouse, you know, in the middle of the workday. Because it's joy, you know, and so we have to do that. So there is nothing wrong with loving your children, your grandchildren, but making them so important that my joy and happiness depends on them.
Okay.
So if the child tomorrow doesn't call me,
yeah.
I shouldn't become miserable. Or if the child moves away, you know, some people are so attached. I know one mother when she had an only daughter and they were living in Bakersfield. When the daughter went to college, she actually left home and took an apartment next to the college. so she could be with the daughter and left the husband here. Husband works. Now that is attachment. That is attachment where you're so dependent on the child that if I don't see her every day, or some people have to talk to the child every day. I mean, if it's good, but after a while, they have their own life. You know, they're not going to call you every day. They'll get fed up of you. So if they call you once a week, or I usually text them, okay, call me on your way home, because they all have long commutes. So they're driving for half an hour, hour. So you talk to them, how's work going? How's the grandkids? And you tell them about yourself. And then once a year, we try to take a vacation where the whole family goes together, all the kids and grandkids. So that way you stay close to them, but don't get so dependent that without my child, my life is incomplete. I have my own life and they have their own life. As long as they're doing well, may God be with you. That's wonderful. Talk to them when you can, love them, help them as much as you can, you know, to get their career started. But do not make them the focus of your life, that my life only revolves around my kids. No, I have my own life and I have my own journey. I have my spiritual journey. But I cannot leave my children. And also do not limit your love to just your child, but extend the love to the world so that everybody's children are divine. But yeah, no, there is no harm in, you know, loving your children, grandchildren, talking to them, seeing them, go to visit them. Now Christmas, I'm flying, you know, to visit my grandkids. Thanksgiving, we meet. So we do all those things. You know, obviously, you can't just say, okay, I'm detached and become a monk and leave that. Because we are not that evolved. We're not at the level of Buddha where he could leave his wife and son and go to the forest. So while we are working, so for us, I think loving them, but without becoming so dependent on them for my happiness.
You're talking exactly what I needed to hear.
Right.
To kind of fine-tune my question.
Yes.
And my concern. You know, a long time ago, our last baby died shortly after I was born.
Sorry.
And then raising the other two children, I was just terrified all the time
of
losing him.
Right.
And I think if I if I got anything out of a relationship with God, you know, it would be to not live in such fear.
Right.
And you know, I think detachment is a tool with which to do that.
Right.
But I struggle with, I don't know how to say, you know, if my child died, it wouldn't affect me, or...
It will affect you, of course. It will affect you very badly. And that you don't become heartless. In fact, the spiritually evolved soul becomes more soft and more loving, actually becomes more sensitive. Detachment does not mean you become insensitive or become hard like a rock. Actually, the more you evolve spiritually, the more softer you will become, the more loving you will become.
Yeah.
More. And so if a child dies, it will hurt you. But at the same time, if you have this knowledge, you realize that each soul comes with a particular lifetime for this life, I have certain amount of karmas I have to do and some vasanas I have to exhaust. And so for that baby who died, his or her life was only a few days. And that was all for that particular soul to fulfill those karmas in that lifetime and then move on.
Yep.
So once you know that, then there is no grief.
Okay, well, here's the thing. So I live in fear. My children were growing up.
Right.
You know, and the fear made me hard.
Right.
As opposed to the soft soul
that you're
talking about. You know, and it's like...
Because
I worship the God of fear.
Right.
And this God makes a person hard rather than soft.
Right.
And it's... How do you know? It's
you worship the God of love rather than the God of fear.
Well, somewhere in there is a tremendous source of courage.
Right.
I mean, not to fear death of your child.
Right.
I don't, how can you not fear the death of your child?
Because whatever the life expectancy for that child is, neither you or I can cut it short. Even some people go in a plane crash,
yep,
and 200 people die, 2 people survive. You know, how did that happen? They were not meant to die. On the other hand, if there is this particular being has only come for this particular amount of time, you or I cannot save it. So realize that there is a higher power that is working. And again, this higher power is not empirically taking my child. For that particular individual, that particular lifespan was all that was meant to be. That's why some people live 90, 100. Some people die at 6 hours. Some people die at 6 years. Some people die at 16, 60. So you have to accept that this individual was here only for its fulfilling of this particular purpose for which it came. And after that, it moves on. Once you know that there is a life after death, then there is, you know, then there is no fear, because nobody dies. It's just a station. You stop. I always talk about life journey as a train, that I'm going on the train and different passengers come and we stay for a while. We become friends, and then when the station comes, the passenger leaves, and another passenger comes and becomes my friend. And when it's my station, I leave the train, and the train goes on. So life is like a train where each one of us is on this train of this earth, and different people come, my wife, my child, my grandchild, and they are my co-passengers. And then some of the, like our high school friends, I'll never leave you, you're my best friend. Now, do you even think about them? Do you even call them? Otherwise, you couldn't live a moment without them. So they were meant for those 16 years or 12 years or whatever, and of my schooling. They were my co-passengers. Now they are gone. They're probably somewhere else. So think of life as a train. And when it's my time to get down, I'll get down too. The train's journey is over.
So it's perspective.
Yes, it's perspective.
Life beyond...
Right. So I think the more knowledge you have, it makes you more comfortable.
Well, think about our mortality. I mean, our nature is to die. Our nature is to any time.
Right.
Anytime. Sometimes when I have, you know, those feelings, I go back to God and I said to myself, thank you, I am alive, because there are so many people, friends, you know, that I know, they are not there, and I am here.
Yeah.
Right.
And I can go any time, any moment.
Yes.
So any moment, what I should do is say, thank you very much,
mm-hmm,
because I am.
Right.
Because I am here, and at least one of my child is gone, but I have 2 more, or I have my wife, I have my house, I have so many.
Right.
Sometimes we give everything for granted, you know, that we are supposed to have a beautiful life with everything.
Exactly.
And that's another story.
And the child was only there for a short while, because that was the end of its life for that. Its karmas, you know, was only there for a particular purpose. That child came for a few hours. Maybe it came to teach me a lesson, you know, to learn to accept acceptance. If I don't accept, that's when the problem arises. You say, okay, that's meant to be, and that's it. Just quieten your mind. Relax the body. Observe the breath. Slow, deep breaths, and just watch the breath. Let us watch the thoughts like a thought parade. Deep breaths, and when the mind becomes still, then the thoughts will die down. If the thoughts are still bothering me, just watch them like a witness. And pay attention to who is the witness, who is the one that is witnessing the thoughts. Say, I am. Who is that I that is a witness? of these thoughts. So keep on watching the breath, deep breaths. And when thoughts arise, be a witness. And that witness I am. That consciousness I am. When you watch the thoughts, they will slowly die down. But be alert. Do not let the thoughts take you for a ride. remember to chant Om as often as you can, either audibly or silently. That will help you a lot.